Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. You've weaved through the technicalities it takes to get the show on the air, and we're back on the air after missing 1 week. I'm kidding. Of course, it couldn't be easier to get a radio show started than on Blog Talk Radio. And take a look at the list. The list keeps expanding of the interesting people that have radio shows and the topics they're talking about. It's just about everything. And we're one of the zillions on Blog Talk Radio show now, or the network. And remember, it costs absolutely nothing for you to get a radio show, and you can be up and cranking on that thing in about probably about three minutes. But welcome to Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. And I think you're going to enjoy this. I'm sorry we skipped away last week, but tonight we're going to have another one about internet security and privacy and that type of business. And most of you have been listening over the years realize I'm not one of these nuts about privacy. You know, I don't want to take away your house number and license plates from cars and all that silliness. But I do think we are in danger of a lot of things in terms of protecting our privacy. And tonight we're going to have Julia Anglin talk about her book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. And she is really good. I'll talk more about her when we get to that segment of the show. But she's a Pulitzer Prize winner and was a Wall Street Journal reporter. And, you'll hear more about her. But she is really, really good. And she's found out some things that made her cut back on things like Google and all sorts of other things. And most people just don't realize this. When I get to the first news story tonight, I think maybe you might realize some of these things, because California is kind of a target worldwide with these real good hackers because of a number of reasons, all the businesses in California and money and that type of thing. But anyway, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Show. We want to thank Mike Sorrento and Lucy Spears for being here, and of course Audrey England. Purpose of the show is kind of take a look at some news and issues and events and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We dedicate the show to these tireless criminal justice professionals, and we use that term broadly, and the investigative reporters such as Julia Anglin go out and check into kind of things that we should be knowing about. And thank heavens we have a free press, right? First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and we have thousands, hundreds of court decisions, that's thousands actually, that support our right to have Free Press. But a lot of things are going on, and I can't talk about all of them tonight because I do want you to hear the major portion of what she's doing, and then I always try to tempt you to go to booktv.org and then listen to the rest of the show. I think her presentation is about 54 minutes, and she's interviewed the president and the chief executive officer of the National Constitution Center, and that's Jeffrey Rosen, and he does a real nice interview, very, very polite and talented man. So you're listening on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, any interest group, any person, any organization can have their own show. I'm surprised these politicians and people running for office aren't jumping on the chance. I don't notice a lot. There's probably 5,000 of them on there. But if you're running for office and or you have an office, why not have a radio show where you can reach the world without having to call in some, you know, some ABC reporter or whatever type of reporter to get your word out? You can do that. And it's more than just having a Facebook. I mean, this is you can actually talk with the people. If you want to call in tonight, we're not going to have much time at all. But it's 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983. We do that after the presentation if we actually get done with it. Okay, let's start out tonight. What we usually start with is a blonde joke. And how do you like this blonde joke? Let me know if you enjoy this blonde joke. It says, how do blondes put on slippers? How do blondes put on slippers? And the answer to that is, it's too early to tell. They haven't found them yet. I don't know how funny that one is. But they can't put on their slippers because they haven't found them yet. But anyway, that's interesting. Right, the Iowa Coalition Against Gun Control, I mean, they have a message that they want you to hear. Iowa Coalition Against Firearms. They get their name wrong all the time. It's the Iowa Coalition Against Firearms, and they want you to hear this message, go down and turn in your firearms. Right? Right.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
I think it's one of my news stories tonight, just a little brief one. I'll just mention it now. Starbucks has changed their mind about people carrying concealed in their restaurants. Now, I guess they're not going to allow that for some reason. You know, all has to do with business one way or the other. Okay, we have a green tip for tonight, and this comes from Esma Floyd's little book called 1001 Ways to Save the Planet, and I know you're going to like this one. Fan yourself cool. This is tip number 544. A ceiling fan in an office is a better choice than air conditioning because it uses much less electricity and it moves the air around the room to produce drafts that are cooling. A healthier choice than artificial cooling in air conditioning. Isn't that great to know that? I think it's a great idea to use a fan. Oh. No, it is. Stop that noise. You guys back there in the back room shouldn't do that. Make fun of this kind of thing. Well, let's take a look at some of the news here tonight before we get into the interview with Julia Angwin, which I think you're going to learn something new. Every time you listen to somebody that's done an in-depth work in the cybersecurity business relative to privacy, et cetera, I learn something new, and I think you do, and I've been hanging around this stuff since the beginning of time. So let's take a look at some of these news stories and see what we've got. And the first one here talks about California. International criminal enterprises follow the money, right? So now they're focusing on California because of its wealth and innovation. And aside from a long time trafficking in drugs, guns, and people, the report by California Attorney General Kamala Harris says criminals are turning to cybercrime to target business and financial institutions. This is the first comprehensive report to outline the effects international criminal organizations are having on Californians and businesses. She says she's set to formally release a 181-page report. And the AP reporter got this ahead of time, but California leads all states in the number of computer systems hacked or infected by malware. And these nations are primarily Eastern Europe. Guess where they're from? Russia, the Ukraine, Romania, some of the world's best hackers, Israel, Egypt, China, and Nigeria, as well as other places. You've probably gotten one of 14 million little emails from Nigeria, right? At one time or another, offering you something you can't refuse and should refuse. But anyway, we're going to hear more about that tonight. I thought this one was just too much. This is when the, I think this was in the Chronicle Higher Ed. Am I wrong about that? Anyway, Mike, where was that? Where'd you get that? I think it was Chronicle Higher Ed, but don't quote me. It might have been an AP story. It says, we live in the golden age of Q, and we have a scholar who, over a number of decades, has spent his whole life studying cute. What's cute? You know, we like little babies with broader eyes as opposed to ones whose eyes are closed. A new paper titled, Isn't She Adorable? Cuteness as Political Neutralization. In the star text of Zoe Deschanel, whoever that is, attempts to dissect the quirky allure of the actress and magician. She plays the ukulele, which is a cuter, smaller guitar. She bakes cupcakes, which are a lot cuter and smaller cakes. Her clothes are often faux frumpy. And then she has those doll-like eyes. But this guy, psychologists are working to figure out the evolutionary roots of cuteness. Oh, I hope these aren't federal grants that are paying for that research. Please, could you check that out, Mike? The prevailing theory is that we find babies cute because if we didn't, we wouldn't put up with their early annoying stages and our species would perish from the earth. Cuteness saves lives. I'm not kidding you. This is a study. Cuteness saves lives. For instance, they found one study that some subjects become more physically careful when carrying out a task after they've been primed by photos of cute babies. In other words, we want people to be more careful. Maybe we do that by driving, put pictures of cute babies in our car and they'll drive more carefully. I'm not kidding. This is a paper that talks about all these kind of things. People want to cuddle mini Coopers. You know that little car that you can get 2 feet in, I think. I think you can get both feet in at the same time. But I would say when I see a Mini Cooper, you ought to have one for each foot. but anyway, can you believe that? The evolution of awe and cuteness, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about that as we go through. I sure want to cuddle a Mini Cooper. Oklahoma's a little dilemma here. Have you heard what's going on there? What they're trying to do is execute some folks that deserve execution, and Oklahoma is one of the state in the nation. When you read a sentence in the newspaper, that sentence is going to happen. Oklahoma will do it. Most other states, including the one I live in, you read a sentence in the paper, the chances of that happening are probably less than half. And I keep using an example of my high school classmate who was murdered in brutal murder, and the guy got life in prison, and he did 12 years in the state of Ohio, one of the most brutal murders that you can think of. I need to stop talking about that. It's not polite, but Oklahoma, you can believe it. But what they're running out of is the drugs for the lethal injections, and this is not a new problem. This has been going on at least a year. So what they did is they actually put off the execution so they can drive around or browse around and see if they can find something else, but they use the three-drug cocktail, I think, there. They have difficulty finding pentobarbital, a sedative, and then vicurionium bromide, a muscle relaxant. The state also uses potassium chloride to stop the inmate's heart. I think that's a big one, right? That's the one that counts. Some of these states have now gone to the one drug, a big one drug, that takes you down. I think that's what Ohio does, if I'm not mistaken, but you know, the other thing is, you ever heard of the firing squad? Some states have that as a backup in case, you know, there's constitutional restrictions found about the method they've been using. They use the firing squad, but the firing squad always works. You know, 4, 5, 6 guys shoot a bullet into somebody and it's over. I mean, there's no suffering whatsoever. It's done. But I guess we don't like the appearance of that for that kind of thing. Um, Starbucks. I already talked about that. There's more to that story. We won't want to do that. Wisconsin town acts as a dumping ground for sex offenders. That's been a problem all over the United States. It doesn't get much coverage. You know, we have sex offenders and they get released from prison or they get put on probation or something like that. You know, where are you going to put them? Well, they're supposed to register in the area where they live. Well, this is Oshkosh, Wisconsin residents think they are shouldering an unfair burden for having 63% of the city's sex offenders living in one zip code. Ooh, can you believe that? One zip code. Oshkosh is not the smallest place in the world. According to the Oshkosh Northwestern Media, of the 201 registered sex offenders, 126 of them live in 54901. Must be a good place to be careful. I mean, watch your children. That type of thing. But they're saying that the corrections department is kind of using this like a dumping ground. And he said, well, they're required to live in the county where they're convicted, and they'll have to probably try to do something about that. But where are you going to put them? Oh, I got an idea. You could leave them in prison. Oh, no, that'd be terrible. Oh, I can't go into this one. This is this has to do with our First Lady and obesity. And now it turns out that there's been a little turning and twisting of the books and figures that all this move thing and eat right or whatever it's called hasn't really worked, as people have said. But anyway, check that out for yourself. That's a Reuters news story. It says a plunge in U.S. preschool obesity, not so fast, the experts say. And so that interesting. This one is just absolutely incredible. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this. If you've ever looked at a photo of yourself online and cringed, you might not be surprised by a new study that suggests selfies, the pictures of yourself, are contributing to an increase in the number of people seeking plastic surgery. According to the American Academy of Facial, Plastic, and Reconstructive Surgery, 1 in 3 plastic surgeons saw a rise in procedures from patients claiming to be unhappy with the way they look on social media. 13% of the doctors surveyed identified increased photo sharing and patients' dissatisfaction with their looks online as a rising trend in the cosmetic surgery industry. Can you believe that? 58%, what's even more disturbing, 58% of these surgeons surveyed said that they saw an increase in requests for cosmetic surgery and injectables in patients under the age of 30. So over half of these people, with women looking to keep their skin looking younger and longer, men seeking things like rhinoplasty, acne, scar removal, and chin implants. But I guess they're not worried about the tattoos all their body. Oh, my gosh. But with Snapchat and iPhone and selfies and all that kind of stuff, these people are just infatuated with this business. Google Glass, I'm going to wait till they actually come out for the public before we start talking about that. But you know what Google Glass is? That's a little set of glasses. It's like a computer you're wearing, and you can look through one of your eyes and flash and all kinds of junk. And there's going to be all kinds of stuff about that. There are places, the people that have the experimental versions, I guess, pre-versions of the thing, they've had them for a couple of years now, they're actually banned in some places. They're not allowed to go in there because people don't want to be constantly photographed and talk to and that kind of thing. Hands-on Google Glass. But that was interesting. Senegal bans smoking in public. How about that? Oh, boy, this is going to be big. We got cops now wearing body cameras all over the place. That's not a new idea. That goes back 10 years. I had one of those little things that fit up alongside your ear, which you could take pictures of people. But isn't that incredible that we're gonna take so many pictures of so many things, and now they got that program that you can get that reads your face, and it'll go to a database and from social media and find out what your name is, where you live, all the other junk. You'll hear our commentator tonight talking about what she found out relative to some of these things. Mobile apps. Let's skip that one. Idaho just passed a law that the governor signed it that said you can carry concealed carry guns on campus. That would be retired law enforcement officers and individuals who hold CCW permits to carry guns on campuses. Idaho's 8 public college and university presidents opposed the legislation. Well, I guess the presidents are now going to have to follow the registration. Here's the last one we'll talk about tonight. If you're going to go out and mug somebody on the street, be careful that a U.S. Marine or ex-Marine isn't standing around. Semper Fi, of course. I spent some 4 years and 3 months in the Marine Corps. Boston purse snatchers, beware. U.S. Marines are notorious for stopping crime on city streets at home or abroad. When a woman was walking along Beach Street in Boston's Chinatown on Tuesday night, this past, she had her purse stolen. Her scream alerted a 23-year-old Marine from Corona, California, who immediately took action. The alleged purse snatcher, Dimitri Neely, ran 4 blocks, but eventually the Marine in pursuit caught up and tackled him and held on tight until the cops arrived to make an arrest. This young man saw that what was happening, and he sprinted into action, says the Suffolk District Attorney. The woman received her purse back and confirmed that nothing was missing. She was lucky to have a good Samaritan out for her, but even luckier that he was a Marine, says Mr. Conley. He told the Globe. That's the district attorney. So it'd be nice to have some more Marines out there on the street protecting. I guess there's one ex-Marine I can remember as a cop chasing a guy in downtown Dayton, Ohio for about 30 minutes and finally got him. But anyway, that's enough of the news stories for tonight. Now we're going to take a listen to Julia Angwin. She's going to talk about the many ways that the government, private business, and criminals can collect our private data. She argues that due to the pervasiveness of the dragnet system we live in today, we are in danger of becoming a society that self-censors itself instead of demanding our rights. And this event was hosted here by the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and she will be interviewed, as I said, by Jeffrey Rosen, who is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Julie Angwin is an investigative journalist now for ProPublica. She was previously a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and she was part of a journal team that won the Pulitzer Prize in 2003 for their coverage of corporate corruption. No, we don't have corporate corruption, do we? Yes, I guess we do. She's the author of other books called Stealing My Space and The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. And you can find this on booktv.org. And give me a little time to set this up because, you know, C-SPAN is so loaded with visitors. Sometimes it locks up a little bit. So give me some time. We'll be listening to Julia Angwin talk about her book called Dragnet Nation.
Welcome to the National Constitution Center. Such a pleasure to see you here. I am Jeffrey Rosen. I am the president of this wonderful institution. The National Constitution Center is the only institution in America chartered by Congress to disseminate information about the U.S. Constitution to several books about the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, to the history of the Second Amendment. Here at the Constitution Center, it is constitutional heaven every day of the week, and we are so proud to share it with you. Finally, I'll just say, please do look at our new and redesigned website, constitutioncenter.org. All of these great new programs, as well as our weekly podcasts, can be found on our homepage, and we hope you'll enjoy them as much as we've enjoyed presenting them. My friends, ladies and gentlemen, out of all the topics that I'm privileged to discuss here at the great National Constitution Center, there is none that I'm more excited about than privacy, and there's no author that I've been more looking forward to meeting in person and talking with than Julia Angwin. We are fellow soldiers in the privacy trenches for many years. As journalists, we've both written about privacy, and there's no reporter in America from whom I've learned more than Julia. Your pathbreaking reports in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere about the tangible harms of online tracking and especially the details about how much precisely is being collected and what is being done with it are unparalleled. You were a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2012 because of your incredible Wall Street Journal series on this subject, which revealed for the first time something that many of us hadn't known, which is that, among other harms, people are actually charged different prices online based on the profiles that faceless algorithms create about us without our knowledge or consent. Let me just finally introduce Julia properly, with note some of her other many great achievements. She is currently a journalist at the wonderful and independent news organization ProPublica. She was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal from 2000 to 2013 and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2011. She was on a team of reporters that won the Pulitzer in 2003 in explanatory reporting for coverage of corporate corruption. She's also the author of Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. We are so thrilled, I am so thrilled, to have Julia here to discuss her latest book, Dragnet Nation, Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you.
We have so much to discuss. I'm going to start with the obvious opening question. What surprised you most about how much companies and the government know about you?
Well, thanks for having me here. I'm a huge fan of your work as well, and a great introduction. Thank you. In my book, Dragnet Nation, I decided to take the privacy investigations I'd done at the Wall Street Journal a step further by investigating myself, right? What's known about me, and what can I protect? And so I sought my data from as many places as I could find, which actually was very few places. So, for instance, I identified 200 data brokers out there, but only a dozen would let me see my files because there is no law requiring them to. But interestingly, even in that small set of files, it was shocking how wrong some of them were and how right some of them were. So some companies were completely wrong about me. One company said I had never completed college, I was a single mother, and I had a very poverty-level income. And that none of those things happened to be true. Other files were incredibly detailed and had every address I had ever lived at, going back to the number on my dorm room in college, which I had actually forgotten. And every member of my family perfectly associated to me, and all sorts of purchases that I had made, including ones I had made fairly recently. So on the whole, they knew a lot about me. And occasionally, they knew all sorts of wrong things about me, and I couldn't decide which one actually outraged me more.
Were you surprised by how much Google knew? It was the depth and precision of your searches that surprised me and actually freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah, so my Google search history was incredibly shocking to me. So since I joined Gmail in 2006, they had been storing all my searches, and that's a long time. And when I started to look at my searches, I realized how revealing they were. They were far more revealing than my addresses, because it was a map of every single day. I would wake up in the morning and I would Google the weather, and then I would Google, you know, something about something with my kid's school, was it open? Then I would look at what article I was writing, researching that topic. Then I would start weirdly shopping for online kids' clothing. And you could just see my mind making its little leaps. And the idea that there was a record of the mental madness that goes on really disturbed me. And I quit using Google Search after that.
We'll talk about the alternatives and how you cope with them, but there was more that struck me. You've got your TSA records and found that the description of why you were going abroad for a reporting trip was actually reported to private companies and then turned over to the government.
Yeah, this was shocking. So I went to the Customs and Border Patrol and I said, give me the record of my border crossing. That's one of the few sets of files that you can obtain from the government fairly easily if easily means waiting 3 months and writing letters. And right, that's a relative standard, right? So it was incredibly comprehensive, and what I learned from it was that the Wall Street Journal, where I was working, used a travel agency, which used a system that basically automatically sent some of the internal communications that I had with my boss. I had to fill out a little online form about why was I traveling, et cetera, and my boss would approve it, and that's how my travel would get approved. And just by the virtue of sort of like no one paying any attention, all those communications were swept into the government files. And so when I brought this to the Wall Street Journal, they understandably flipped out because, you know, advanced knowledge of where reporters are going about what story is something probably they don't want the government to have. So they actually stopped working with that travel agency for a period of time until they got it fixed. And it was, but it took quite a bit of time. And this is one of the many problems of this data age that we live in right now, is people don't even know where the data is going. If I had asked the Wall Street Journal where is the data, they would have said, oh, it's secure, it's right here, and they didn't know.
The amount of inaccuracies, the glitches, it would seem very hard to get a sense of control and a handle on just how much was out there.
Yeah, it was very difficult to get a handle on it, and I'm sure I don't have a handle on it. I've probably seen some very thin layer at the top of what's really known about me. Because, as I said before, most companies don't have to share it. Or even if they do share it, for instance, Facebook let me download an archive of what they had on me. But we know, actually, from a European who obtained a fuller set of his data from Facebook under stricter European privacy laws, that what I saw was less than what they had. Because his file, it had everyone who he had deleted as friends, and it had posts that he had deleted. So it actually kind of kept this ghostly records of things that he thought were gone, whereas the one I saw was a more sanitized version.
Okay, well, we're going to discuss in a little bit the steps you took to protect your privacy. But before we do that, I want to talk through with you a question that both of us get all the time. Whenever you speak about privacy, people say, what's the harm? Nothing to hide, nothing to fear. I'm not doing anything wrong. Why should I care if Google does my search results? And the great virtue, one of the many great virtues of this book, is that you enumerate those harms with great specificity and you give us specific examples of people who were harmed in different ways. Let's start with government surveillance.
Okay.
And you talk a lot about Edward Snowden and the PRISM program and the fact that the government is collecting the metadata, that is the telephone numbers that we dial and so forth and the duration of the calls, as well as intercepting the content of some conversations. I'm not a terrorist. Why should I care? What harm?
Right. So this is the most common question.
Usually I get it. I'm sorry. But it was a pleasure for me to be able to ask you that question.
Right.
Why are you so upset about privacy? Aren't you? You must be a terrorist.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's interesting, first of all, that we even have this harm conversation because it's worth noting that in Europe, there's no need to justify this. Privacy is considered a human right, and it's just a given. You don't have to have this conversation. Putting that aside, though, this is the U.S. We want to debate this, so let's debate it. The thing that I think is the biggest harm from government surveillance, actually, is that it leads us to be less free with our speech. So I write about this guy in my book who was surveilled by the FBI. He and his friend, they're both teenage young men in Santa Clara, and his friend had written a kind of sassy post on a social network called Reddit, and he had basically said, I don't know why the TSA is so crazy at airports. You know, I could just go to a mall and bomb it, no problem, right? Which is actually true, but, you know, maybe unwise to say, but he said it. So a couple weeks later, this guy and his friend were at the car shop getting an oil change, and the friend, the author, saw that there was something under his car. It was a tracking device. And the FBI had put this on his car to surveil him, and he later found out that it was because of his friend's comment. So this is already kind of a disturbing story, but what I found really disturbing was what happened afterwards. So after they found out they were being surveilled by the FBI, their friendship fell apart. The author didn't want to be friends with a guy who might put him in danger, right? He became incredibly circumspect in his actions, and he doesn't feel free to talk about it. And he is Muslim, American, and he now uses a different name, Aladdin, because he feels like it's less Muslim. And he's still detained every time he comes across international borders. And he doesn't feel like he has the same sort of free speech rights that I feel like is a central part of our country.
You argue so powerfully in that chapter that it's not just privacy, but free speech that's at stake, that at the core of what the framers were concerned about was enough practical obscurity to be able to engage in political dissent. And yet, as you say, the Supreme Court has not been sympathetic to claims that mass surveillance violates free speech.
No, the Supreme Court has not. And there are a number of reasons why they've taken that path. But largely, it's been over this issue of standing, which is that you can't prove you're surveilled and so that you can't show any harm. You know, we have an interesting case coming up, which is now after Snowden, people can prove that they were surveilled. And so it'll be interesting to see whether the Supreme Court revisits that. But one thing that I talked about in that chapter, I called it freedom of association, because actually even more than speech, I was concerned about association, because the author was afraid to associate with his friend anymore. And what big data is really a way to build associations, right? people who collect big data say the thing that they love about it is you suddenly realize that people who buy felt pads to put under their furniture are better credit risks. And you would never have seen that in any other data because it was too small, as they say. And so it builds association. But we do have a history of protecting freedom of association, right? The NAACP versus Alabama case, where Alabama wanted the list of members of NAACP, and the Supreme Court upheld the right to keep that list private. Now, the thing is, those lists are no longer private because you don't have to join the Young Muslim Men of Santa Clara anymore. Yasser was automatically entered into that by the digital trail that he left behind.
In addition to those great First Amendment concerns, you also identify Fourth Amendment concerns, and you actually went to the former East Germany and found out what the Stasi knew about its citizens. How much more or less did the Stasi know than Google knows about you?
Right. Well, so the Stasi, if they really wanted you, there were a couple people on whom they had dozens of binders. They measured their surveillance in binders, right? So some people had like 30 binders, 50 binders. But I looked at average files, which were 20 to 50 pages long, handwritten. I got them translated by Stasi experts. And they were not as robust as what I was a typical Facebook profile, even. Because nowadays, Facebook, their timeline dates back several years, and you can see quite a bit about someone. Now, that's not to say that they didn't know how to be repressive. They were far more repressive a government. And, you know, I always want to be cautious with this, which is that we are better at surveillance, but not as good at repression. And I think that we want to make sure we keep it that way.
Does it work? You tell the story of Zazi, who I guess is one of the people who the government has offered as an example of someone who was caught through this prison surveillance. And yet it's not clear that the surveillance itself was the cause of it and that he might not have been caught without it.
Yeah, the Zazi case is the one that the government uses most often to defend the NSA's bulk surveillance programs ever since the Snowden revelations. And Zazi was the guy who wanted to blow up the subways in New York City. And they did identify him because he had written an email to somebody in overseas who was a known terrorist. And they did catch that through the prison program. Now, the thing is, though, you don't need a bulk surveillance program to monitor communications to known terrorists. We actually have a process for that. It's called go to get a secret warrant to monitor communications of terrorists. And so that was their tip. But basically, they caught him by literally chasing him across the country in cars. He was driving from Denver to New York, and they had like a team of agents trailing him. It was incredibly old school.
Now, the GPS device that Yasser was followed by was a formal search that the Supreme Court later struck down in the Jones case and said that you're not allowed to put a GPS device on the bottom of a car and track people's movements 24/7 for a month. What about the future of Fourth Amendment issues? You talk about fascinating cell phone tracking cases. You say it's currently open whether or not the government is allowed, now that they can no longer put a GPS device on the bottom of my car, they can just subpoena the geolocational information stored by AT&T or Verizon or whatever it is.
Right.
And some folks in Congress are saying you need a warrant for that. The government is pushing back.
Right.
What will the courts do? What
so we have the problem we have with the Fourth Amendment and these devices.
Time now, not to track your
Wait, but they are the best tracking device ever devised, right? We keep them next to our beds. I mean, like, any spy would love their target to carry such a thing.
Yeah.
So the problem is the Fourth Amendment, there's the way the court has interpreted it has been very much about the boundaries of your actual home. So the Fourth Amendment protects the papers and effects in your home. And so the interpretation has been that if you give your information to somebody outside the home, a third party, such as the phone company or bank, you have a lesser expectation of privacy in those records. And so that allows the government to get your cell phone records with less of a legal standard. And that is known as the third-party doctrine. In the Jones case that you referenced, Justice Sotomayor suggested that it might be time to reconsider that in a world where we basically store all of our papers in third-party servers. But that hasn't yet been opened up by the court.
This is a law professor's question. I'm only asking because I don't know the answer and I'm interested in it. What is the best alternative to the third-party doctrine? In other words, so Justice Sotomayor says, we have a problem. You know, what would the Supreme Court say if I take data and store it in a database held by a third party, I have no expectation of privacy in it. That means none of us have any privacy. But she didn't say what the court should do as an alternative.
Well, I mean, I don't know that I know the answer, but I think it's worth pointing out that all of the tech companies, from AT&T to Google to Facebook, are lobbying to get that particular part of the law changed. They want the search warrant to be the standard for cell phone location records, email, really sensitive data that currently, because of the third-party doctrine, is easier for the government to get.
So as you say, Congress could pass a bill saying you need a warrant to get access to this information,
yes.
And that would help things.
Yes, it would.
I'm just going to throw it out there, so maybe you can, if you like it, you can push it as well. But I love your First Amendment argument so much. And whenever I have a hard privacy question, I ask, WWBD, what would Brandeis do? Because he's my privacy hero. And I think he would have insisted that the framers believed that a degree of practical obscurity and anonymity was necessary for full democratic participation, and forms of ubiquitous tracking that defeat that expectation are unreasonable searches of our persons and electronic effects. What do you think of that?
I think that certainly Brandeis would agree with that. I think it's interesting. I heard an argument recently that I thought was interesting, which was maybe the Second Amendment should protect us, the right to bear counter-surveillance, which I thought was actually a great idea, right? Because I have kind of armed myself with counter-surveillance, right? And that puts me on a suspicious list, actually. But it may well be that, like, there's a level of anonymity needed for political discourse that would be prevented, would be allowed by this, right? By the fact that I have my phone in a bag that prevents all signals from getting through.
So tell about this incredible Faraday bag. This is the hottest privacy fashion accessory for the spring. All fashionable privacy advocates will carry them. What is this?
So what this is basically a bag that's lined with some thin metal, and the metal prevents any signals from getting in and out. So when my phone is in the bag, then it's not communicating with the cell towers or with any Wi-Fi network. It's really just off the grid. And it saved me from having to constantly think, okay, have I got my location setting on or whatever? And so I just throw it in the bag, and then I'm not trackable. And it's worth pointing out that, you know, you could turn your phone off to do this, but the head of the CIA chief technical officer went public a year ago saying, you know, we can track you even when your phone is off, which basically probably means remotely activating the microphone or some other part of it. And so true privacy paranoids put their phones in bags. And actually, you know, this is something that protesters do because the cops want to know who's at the protest. And so it's actually commonly used by Occupy and other people.
This is the time for me to use the Woody Allen line, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. Now, the Paradise bag is a far more stylish alternative to your original approach, which is wrapping your phone in tinfoil.
Yes,
How did you feel when you wrapped your phone in tinfoil?
Well, no, I was going to get a Faraday bag, but I was talking to this guy who was an ex-CIA guy, and he was like, oh, honey, you don't need the Faraday bag. You just wrap your phone in tinfoil. I was like, okay, I'll try it. So I spent a day wrapping my phone in tinfoil, and it was really embarrassing. You know, I got to my office, and I was just peeling it open, trying not to tear it, you know, and check something and then put it back in. And by the end of the day, it looked like that very crinkly sandwich smushed look. And my colleague said to me, said, Juliet, I actually know someone who can get you a Faraday bag, so you have to stop doing this because you look crazy.
Where do you get them, buddy?
So you can get them on Amazon. This one I got from a guy who's like an art, he does counter-surveillance art in New York, and it's called the Off Pocket.
We could start up a little operation at the Constitution Center and sell them together. You know, it would be a great franchise.
The Constitution plus a pocket. I think that's a great idea.
But now, Faraday bags, obviously some of our audience, well, actually, I'm kind of curious. Based on our conversation so far, who in the audience would buy a Faraday bag?
Oh, right. Wow. This is
and who thinks that this is just too much and would not buy the Faraday bag?
Okay.
So this is actually almost two-thirds. So it's a hearty and already committed audience here at the Constitution Center today. But I think we have a little more work to do to persuade the non-Faraday bag people about what the harms are. So again, the great virtue of this book, there are stories, there are practical tips about how to protect your privacy, but you really give us the harms. So we've talked about the harms of government surveillance. Let us talk about the harms of private sector surveillance and being tracked by online companies. And I mentioned the great contribution of your Wall Street Journal articles was to reveal that people may be charged different prices online based on who the companies think they are. Tell us about that example of differential pricing.
Great. So what's happening now when you are online is your computer transmits far more information about you than you would think, right? You imagine yourself being very anonymous. But when you arrive at a website, and it's a retailer website, or somebody's trying to sell you something, they already have quite a bit of information about you, and they can dynamically change the page to tailor it exactly to you. This is actually marketed to you as personalization and as a benefit. And sometimes it is. When Amazon tells you what books you might want, I'm fine with that. Although the only books they ever tell me are like, you know, NSA stuff. <Yes, okay. laughs> I already have them all. What I wanted to find out at the Journal in some of my investigations was, well, how is this being used to provide different prices? Because that's what I think is ultimately what I would want to do if I was a retailer. And so we did find, in 2010, we found that Capital One was using this information to change the credit card it offered you as the first, when you just went to their website, they had never seen you before, and it was like, boom, here's the card for you, right? And it was kind of disturbing because we analyzed the traffic that your website sent back and forth to them, and it said in the traffic, it would say their instant analysis, like low income or middle income, and how much education they thought you had. Now, let's be fair, you can apply for any credit card you want, right? So your choice isn't being fully limited, it's only just being scoped, right, as to what we think you might want. But then in 2012, what we found was that we found Staples was actually changing its prices for everybody, and it wasn't optional, right? As soon as they identified your physical location, they made an instant assessment of how close you were to a competitor store. And if you were close enough, they would give you a better price because they thought maybe you might go to the competitor. And if you weren't that close, they would give you a higher price. And so that was so you could buy a stapler, an actual stapler. We bought two staplers, same exact ones, from two different locations for two different prices and had them shipped to the same location. And this is going to become more and more possible. And what I'm concerned about is, what does that mean? Because, of course, it's perfectly competitive and legal to do discrimination by price, and economists sometimes argue that it's the perfect pricing. But it's also true that when we looked at the data for Staples nationwide, the people who live near competitor stores are lower income and racial minorities, and they're getting the higher prices. They're living farther away from the stores, right, from the competitor store. So they're getting the higher prices. So I think we need to rethink what is redlining, what do we want, what do we consider fair in our system? Because the ability to be unfair is going to increase technologically. And so I just raised the question of where do we want to draw the line as a society of like how willing we are for people to be charged different prices based on their individual attributes.
And you show so powerfully this is very literal classification. You were put in one category that Nielsen or someone thought that you were high-tech spender or something.
Yep.
And then there are the others who are the blue-collar blues, many of whom are minorities, who are charged permanently different prices because of whom Nielsen thinks they are. Should that be illegal?
Right. Well, that is the question we need to confront. I don't think this society has ever had to answer that question. So we have very technical definitions of redlining, mostly having to do with credit and loan applications and racial minorities. And we need to think a little bigger about where else we want to draw those lines. Because the thing about our digital world is that although it seems like when you go onto the Internet you can see anything in the whole world, it's also true that you can be trapped in sort of what I call a hall of mirrors, where all you see is what all those websites think you are, right, and think you want to see and think the price that you should have.
Talk more about this hall of mirrors. You give so powerfully the example of people in the last election who visited Mitt Romney's website only getting Romney ads, and people who visited the Obama website visiting Obama ads. And Julia describes how literally you visit the Romney website and a cookie placed on your computer is auctioned off in real time to a company that earns the right to send you these Romney ads forever. And the result is that we're living in what UAC Research has called a filter bubble, where the ads you see and even the news you consume and the entire reality that you inhabit is defined by who the websites think they are. Talk about that filter bubble.
So in the last election, I found this incredible example of the filter bubble, which was that if you went to Google and typed in Obama and did a search for Obama, then your subsequent searches, whether they were for guns or abortion or just cats, would have guns or whatever at the top, and then three structures open in the middle that were Obama plus, whatever the topic was. So Obama's position on cats, right? Three search results, and then more cats. And when you did the same for Romney, so you searched for Romney, and then your subsequent research results didn't have that, right? There were no Romney plus cats. And so I tested this across the country, and I came to Google with it about a week before the election. I said, what are you guys doing? You know, what's happening here? If we at the Wall Street Journal had said, we noticed that you read the Obama story on the front page, so now the story in Personal Journal about toothpaste is going to have Obama's views on toothpaste, we would literally be strung up, okay? So what's the deal? And they were like, oh, it's just the algorithm. The algorithm found that people who read Obama news want more Obama news, and the people who read Obama news don't want more Romney news. Now, that might actually be true because Obama won Romney news, but is it fair, right? And is it fair for Google to make that assumption for us?
Is it, back to Brandeis, is it consistent with democratic values? Can you live in a society in which we only hear one side of the story?
Right. Well, that's the challenge, right? That's why I really felt at the end of all my reporting that the key issue here was fairness, right? It doesn't make you feel like you live in a fair society if you're not seeing your news presented fairly, right? And so I think we need to figure out ways to make sure that we can keep all the fabulous technology, which I love. I love all of it. I want all of it. I want to be able to, you know, log on to my, you know, remotely from here and get my files from home. But I want to mitigate the unfairness that is right now completely legal and ubiquitous.
Another arm, more unfairness, virtual police lineups and Google Glass. What's going to happen there?
So I talked a little bit in my book about what I call virtual police lineups, which is essentially the idea that before all this surveillance was really ubiquitous, there was no reason that a normal person would have a file with their local police department or would be on file kind of anywhere. But now, for instance, local police departments have these license plate readers, and so they drive around and they scan all the license plates that they're driving by and keep them in a file forever in some cases. And that means that they have kind of a history of your location, where you've been parked for the past 3 years, or if you're driving, they also can take pictures of where you're driving on the street. They photograph the oncoming traffic and the traffic in front and behind. And so what we found was a guy in California who FOIA'd his, he filed a Freedom of Information Act request for his automatic license plate record. And his little town had photographed him, I think, more than 200 times, including his kids getting in and out of his car in the driveway. And that was on file in the police department, and they're going to keep it forever. Right? And so this has changed the presumption of innocence in my mind, right? Which is no longer do you have to be a suspect to be surveilled. And I think that the challenge there is that then the police can go fishing in that data to just look, well, did they get out of the car? Did the kids get out of the car in his driveway in a way that crossed, like, disobeyed some law about, you know, there's so many laws on the books that you don't know, right? It might be illegal to park your car one lot, like, wheel over the edge on the sidewalk. Who knows, right? So now they have a way to find something on everybody.
Like the guy with the GPS device on the bottom of his car who stopped because he turned without making a signal. So all of us, when we drive, violate traffic laws, and the Supreme Court has said, you don't, even if it's a pretext, the stop is okay. You violate some minor law, and you're saying with all of this data, we're all vulnerable to being...
Right. And I tell the story in my book of a guy who I think is a really compelling example of this. He was he's a boiler repairman up in Massachusetts, in Western Mass, and he basically one day got a notice in the mail that his driver's license had been suspended, and he didn't know why. And they said, you have to come to a hearing. So he went there. And they said, we have this facial recognition program, and it found that your photo looked very similar to this other guy, so we think it's identity theft to prove who you are, right? So he was basically chosen, presumed guilty and had to prove his innocence. Well, he was who he was, and their program flagged the wrong people, and they actually accused him. They said, you don't even look like your photo. And he was like, yes, that photo was taken 13 years ago, and I'm 100 pounds heavier now, right? And so like, this was the debate he's having with the DMV. And so that's what happens in this world where the algorithms are sort of unchecked. And I want to build due process into that, right? He needed the right to be informed far earlier.
Digital due process is a very powerful theme of this book.
Yeah.
You, in order to dramatize the difficulty of protecting privacy, spent a year doing a privacy audit on yourself, coming up with a threat model, and then enlisting every available technology to protect your own privacy. We've seen the Faraday bag. Let's talk about some of the other rigors that you endured for the sake of civic discourse. one of the most dramatic of which is you left Google and went to a website called DuckDuckGo. What was that like?
Yeah, so I quit using Google Search because I saw how my searches were so revealing, and I didn't want them stored. And even if you don't have Gmail, they're still storing them based on your IP address, which is a level of anonymity. But in my case, if you go to a website and look up my IP address, it basically locates me right in my home, so they can be very revealing. So I decided to switch to a search engine that's actually based here in Philadelphia called DuckDuckGo that is privacy protected. They don't store any IP addresses and they don't store any searches. So every time I go to them, it's like a fresh new experience. They don't know who I am. So it actually took me a while to learn how to use it because I was used to the idea that Google would finish my sentences. You know, you start typing and then they already know what you want and they fill it in for you. But once I realized that it wasn't that hard to add the word New York at the end of a search just to make sure it wasn't like the Natural History Museum in London, which they love to give me, I really started to appreciate the fact that my searches were tailored because I felt I had the control myself over what I was looking for.
You have many useful tips about creating secure passwords. And I felt, oh, my God, I'm never going to be able to remember them. I mean, like everyone else, I have the obvious one with an exclamation point or something. But at the end of it, and now I realize, I'm like, what do I know? I just write about privacy. What's the takeaway for how people can create secure passwords?
So passwords are a terrible situation right now. So I guess what I ended up doing was basically using a password manager because there's software that will just generate passwords for you because it's impossible for anyone to try to come up with all of these passwords themselves. And then I hired my daughter to use a special technique where she rolled dice and picked words out of a dictionary, and then she strung those words together so that I had 5 random dictionary words, and I used those for my super secure account, so for my email bank and for my password manager. If I was going to say one thing about passwords, if you're going to do one thing, anyone, please just change your email password to the longest possible thing and write it down. The myth that you can't write these things down, the likelihood that someone's going to break into your house, get your wallet or a piece of paper, and then figure out that that's your Gmail password very well.
I mean, you just took a long word. Do you remember, like, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious?
Well, the longer it is, the better, because the password hackers, their programs are designed to just try each letter of the password. So the longer the better. But if it's a well-known phrase like that, the more likely to guess it. That's why I do random words from the dictionary, because those programs are not likely to guess those random words. And also I would just point out that we think we have a good ability to create random words, but our minds are not that random. So it is really better to try to come up with a way to find really random words.
And again, just for those who are not privacy paranoid, why is this important? What's the mud puddle test? And, why should people take the trouble to create?
Well, so passwords are actually really important. Even if you don't believe a single thing that I've been saying about privacy, you don't want to be hacked. And it's becoming incredibly common. And so it's just really important, particularly your email account can be used to reset all of your other passwords and to get into all your accounts. And so
I left that on a bit so that you can hear as much as you could what she's going to say. But I think you ought to go take a look at that on cspan.org. And, again, the book is Dragnet Nation by Julia Angwin. That's all we can do tonight, folks. So we're going to have Vera Lynn sign us off saying we'll meet again.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing song. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know where.